Okay, so let's get started. So, quick recap of last time. We were talking about CPU scheduling algorithm. Okay, so CPU scheduling is basically the problem of how should the operating system kernel pick which job, which process or thread gets to run next on the processor. Okay, so essentially it's a problem of looking at all the jobs in the ready queue and picking one for execution. Okay, so we looked at several policies. Actually, we discussed the first four and we stopped somewhere in the middle of the fourth one. So FCFS is just pick the task at the job at the head, schedule it for execution. It is a non-preemptive policy, which means you will let the job run until it finishes or until it blocks on IO and gives up the CPU. Okay, the kernel does not interrupt the job using time slicing or anything like that. Okay, round robin is a preemptive policy. It uses the notion of time slice. Okay, each job at the head of the job at the head of the queue is scheduled to run. It gets a time slice. If the time slice expires, it has to go to the end of the queue and you pick the next job. Okay, so you round robin between all ready tasks. Shortest job first or SJF picks the job with the least computation time. Okay, so there is a variant of that called SRTF. Both of them are optimal in terms of the waiting times. Okay, because they pick the job with the shortest length and thereby reduce the waiting time of all of the jobs. Okay, and towards the end of the class I was presenting this MLFQ or multi-level feedback queue scheduler. So this algorithm does not require any knowledge of the job length and it tries to approximate shortest job first. Okay, and what it basically does is it uses multiple queues. Each queue has a priority level. Within each queue you do round robin and the time slices increase as you drop in priority. And the basic algorithm is the job starts in the highest priority queue. The time slice expires when you run a job. If it uses its entire time slice, you drop it one priority level. It has to go one level down. If the time slice does not expire, which means the job gives up the CPU because it blocks for IO before the expiration of the time slice, you actually bump it one level up. Okay? So what this essentially do is CPU bound jobs, okay, keep dropping in priority. IO bound jobs stay at a high priority. Okay? And IO bound jobs are precisely ones that have short CPU bursts and long periods of IO. So these are equivalent to your shorter jobs. Okay? So you favor IO bound jobs over CPU bound job. Okay? Without any knowledge of whether a job is IO bound or CPU bound, you just look at its behavior and the behavior are basically specified here. Okay? If you use up your CPU, you are likely to be a CPU bound job. If you don't, you're likely to be an IO bound job. Okay? So here is an example of how MLFQ would treat three jobs here, okay, of length 30, 20, 10. Time slice depends on the queue. Okay? In the highest priority queue, time slice is 1 second, here is 2 seconds, 4 seconds. Okay? Here we assume that all jobs are CPU bound. Okay, then the question is, how do the jobs get serviced by these queues? And then once you figure that out, then you have to also find out the completion time and the wait time. Okay, so let's first try to understand how the jobs get scheduled. Okay, so all jobs are going to start here. Okay, so you have these three jobs, they all arrive at the same time, time zero. They all start in the highest priority queue. Okay, the first one is going to run. Okay, how long will it stay on the CPU? Okay, 1 second. Is that clear? Why? Time slice is 1 second. So it gets 1 second of CPU time and then what happens? Okay, so you will do a context switch. So you will go to the next job, but what happens to the job that just gave up the CPU? Which queue does it have to go to? There is no IO, right? So they're all CPU bound. You say what was the thing you said? Goes down. Okay. Why does it go down? I mean, there are only two options. It has to stay there or drop one level down. The time slice expires without the job doing IO, it will drop. Okay. The time slice does not expire, which means you start doing IO while you are on the CPU, you will either go to the higher level queue or if you are already in the highest, you stay there. These are all CPU bound jobs. There is no IO. Okay, so they will by definition use up any computation time that you give. Okay, so this job is going to drop one level down. Okay, those other two jobs are still in the highest priority queue. This is priority scheduling, so you will not take the next job and run it. Okay, it will again execute for 1 second. Okay, then it has to give up the CPU. Okay, so then that job is also going to drop. Yeah, because it used up its CPU, so by definition you have to go to the lower priority level. And then you run the third job. It runs for 1 second, same thing happens. Okay, now this queue is empty. All the jobs have actually moved to the next lower queue. Okay, now so you will do round robin here, because the queue is empty. Okay, so you will run the first job again. Okay, it has 29 seconds of computation remaining to be scheduled. Okay, so you schedule that job, the one that has had an initial length of 30. How long does it run? 2 seconds. Okay, that's the time slice you give it. Does it use its whole time slice? Yes, it's CPU bound, so it's going to use its whole time slice. Okay, again, that means it has to drop by the rules of MLFQ. If you use your time slice, you drop. If you don't, then you would have risen. Okay, but in this case, you have to drop one level. Okay, so you do the same thing to the next two jobs. So eventually all three jobs are here. Okay, that's what MLFQ does. Okay, that was basically what we said. CPU bound jobs just drop in priority until they go to the lowest priority queue. So all three end up here. Okay, and then you have to do round robin here. Okay, in this case there are no lower priority queues, so you can't drop any lower. Okay, but if there was another queue, you would keep dropping. Okay, so you will do round robin here until each of them gets their CPU times of 30, 20 and 10. So you will give them 4 seconds of CPU time at a time, okay, until you get what you need. Okay, so here is the, so this is essentially what happens. So let me explain the notation. So this 1, 2 and 3, the bold number, they stand for the jobs. Okay, job 1, job 2 and job 3. The superscript tells you how much CPU time have you received. Okay. So this one says after the first time it ran, it got 1 second of CPU time. So total CPU time it has received is 1 second. Okay? And the lower, the subscript is essentially the current time in the system. Okay? At time t equal to 1 second, job one has run. Okay, it got 1 second of CPU time. Okay, and this time one. Okay, and it has actually going to drop. And then two runs, it gets 1 second of CPU time. The clock takes to 2 seconds. Okay, and then three runs, it gets 1 second of CPU time. Clock takes to 3 seconds. At this point, all of these three jobs are moved to the next lower level. So then this one runs, okay, gets 2 seconds of CPU time. Clock takes to 5 seconds. Okay, it goes from 3 to 5. And now this job has received 3 seconds of CPU time. Okay, that's the notation. Okay, and so on. So once they all come down to the third queue, they'll just stay here. Okay, they'll basically just round robin here until they all finish. Okay, that's how you have to work this out. And then you find out that your MLFQ, the first job, I mean job 3 finishes at time 32 seconds. Okay, if you keep doing this, you will see that that's where. So this one actually gets 10 seconds when time t equals 32. So this is going to finish here, that finishes at 53, that finishes at 60. Okay, average completion time is 48 and a third seconds. Comparable, but slightly higher than round robin. Okay, and then wait time. You just use the standard formula, which is wait time is the completion time minus the length of the job. Okay, because they arrive at zero, time zero, there's no arrival time to take into account. So it's a difference between these two columns. Okay, that's the completion time. Any question here? Okay. Here is another example, but in this case, there's one job. It's the same three jobs, but the third job does I/O. Okay, the first two are CPU bound. The third job is going to do I/O. And the I/O behavior, the I/O behavior is specified there. It says 1 second of I/O every other second. So it does 1 second of CPU, then it goes to doing 1 second of I/O. And then when it runs next, it again runs for a second on the CPU and goes back and does I/O for a second and so on and so forth. Okay, it still needs 10 seconds of CPU time. Okay. And the question is, and to simplify it, we just have reduced the number of queues to 2 from 3. Okay, so all three jobs are going to start in the first queue. Okay, so what happens to the first job? Hmm? You need to raise your hand. I can't say who is speaking. Okay, it'll run for 1 second and go down. Nothing has changed, right? The first queue is still 1 second time slice. That's a CPU bound job. It runs for the whole second, okay, and it's going to move to the next slice, to the next queue. Okay, what happens to the next job? Mm-hmm. Same thing. Okay, it's also CPU bound. It'll run here for a second. It'll move down here. Okay. Third job. What does it do? It's also going to go down. It's going to run for a second. Okay. So, here is where I think you have to ask the question, when exactly does it start doing the CPU? If it used up its whole 1 second and then it did CPU subsequently, it did I.O. subsequently, then it would go down. Okay. But for simplicity, we'll assume that it gets 1 second of CPU time, and let's assume that at the last instruction, just before it time has expired, it starts doing I.O. Okay, so then it goes to I.O. But I didn't specify that. So if I had, what you said might be well the case if it does I.O. after it finished 1 second of CPU time. Okay. So you have to always ask, okay, exactly what is the I.O. behavior? Okay, so I had, let's assume for simplicity, it runs for a second. The last instruction just before the time slice expires is an I.O. instruction. Okay. So in this case, what would it do? Yeah, it basically stays there. Well, it doesn't stay there. It has to go into the wait queue at this point. These are the ready queues. Okay, because it was running on the CPU, it started doing I.O., so it will actually be blocked. It will go into a wait queue. It won't be in the ready queue. Okay. When it is done with I.O., it will come back and it will stay here. Okay, because this is the highest priority queue, and that's what you do with I.O. bound jobs. You bump them up until they go up to the top. Yes, if there were more jobs there when it was done with I.O., it has to go back to the end of the queue. It's all round robin. And so when you join at the end of the queue. Okay? So now what? Who's running next in the system? Job 1 runs next. Why is that? That's correct. Job 1 will run next, but why? It's doing round robin. So is this queue empty? It's currently empty because the job that is supposed to be here is still doing I.O. It's on the wait queue. So there's nothing for the scheduler to pick from this queue. The only non-empty queue is this queue. Okay? The first two jobs have dropped and now actually are now in this queue. Okay, so now you will pick that job again, yes.
Would it do the I.O. instruction first, or would it actually do the second priority queue?
Okay, question is, would it do the I.O. instruction first, or would it do the second queue? Good question. Right. So now you should understand how the scheduler and how the job works and how the jobs behave. Has the I.O. instruction executed?
If it was in the first slice.
The I.O. instruction has executed, but the I.O. has not completed. So you have just issued the instruction saying go read this file from disk. You just issued that instruction and then you go and you wait for the disk to actually read your data. Okay, so there's a difference between issuing the instruction and for the I.O. to complete. Okay, so all you have done is you issued your I.O. Okay, now you are waiting in the wait queue waiting for the disk. Disk is slow. So it will take an entire second for the disk to come back with your data. So until then you are blocked. Okay, so that's the way to think about it. Okay, so while you are waiting, the only thing you can do is go to the next queue and start executing these jobs. Okay? So you will take the job with the first job. You will run for time slice 2, okay? CPU bound job. So it will, at the end of 2 seconds, after it got its 2 seconds, it will stay in this queue. Can't drop any further. So it will go back and rejoin the queue. So what happens next? CPU job is done. Yes, CPU job is not. This job is taken is 2 seconds, so it's gone back to the end of the queue. Question is, what happens next in the system? Yeah. Okay, so IO1, if the IO1 is done, it goes next. Is it done? Takes 1 second of IO. This job ran for 2 seconds. So by the time this job is actually, time slice is expired, this job's IO is done. It's back in the ready queue. Okay, so it's rejoined this queue. We are doing priority scheduling, so you always need to pick the highest priority queue that's non-empty. So you have to go back to Q1. Okay? So you run that job again for a second, and we assume the same pattern repeats. The last instruction is an IO instruction. It takes a second. It issues another IO instruction, goes back to the wait queue. Okay? Then that queue, this queue becomes empty again. You go back down here. Okay? So now you have to remember that you had already executed this job. Okay, so now that job is at the end of the queue, the one with 20 is at the beginning of the queue. So you will execute the one with time length 20, it executes for 2 seconds, okay, and the same pattern will repeat. Okay, the IO job will have, the job that was doing IO would have finished, it would have come back here. So you keep alternating between these queue. Whenever the IO bound job has appeared in this queue, execute it, when it goes back to doing IO, you are doing round robin here. Okay, so that's basically what you will see on the next slide. It looks a bit messy, but you will see that you run jobs 1, 2 and 3. Jobs 2 and 3 will go down, rather 1 and 2 will go down. 3 goes back to doing IO. Okay? So at that point, so at time t equals to 3 seconds, you run job 1 for 2 seconds. Okay? And then you come back here and you basically run this job for another second. Come back here, run job 2. Come back here, do this. So you basically keep alternating until this job finishes. At that point, the IO bound job is done. Okay? And then you have only 2 CPU bound jobs left. So you keep cycling between those 2 until they are done. Okay, so you need to be able to work all these things out. Okay, I'm saying what's the exact behavior of MLFQ?
Could you please explain again what those two numbers mean?
Okay, so what do, so this is just for you to, you don't actually need to write this down. This is how you will work it out. So this bold number is a job number, job ID. There are 3 jobs 1, 2 and 3. Okay? The superscript just tells you how much CPU time you have received. Okay? So if the superscript says 15, this says this job has received so thus far 15 seconds of CPU time. Okay? It needs a total of 20 so it can keep going. Okay?
So that's the time of
No, that's how much time you have actually run on the CPU. You just keep adding. Every time you run, you say, I ran for this much more time, you keep adding. Right? So, initially you got 1 second and then you got 2 more seconds, so this incremented to 3, and you got 2 more seconds and incremented to 5 and then 7 and so on. So, it just says, I have received so many seconds of CPU time and you keep going until you finish your job. Okay? The subscript is the current time in the system. Okay, this says at time t equals to 11 seconds, this job ran and now it has received 5 seconds. So this time just keeps in ticking. Okay, so you need this time to know when the job actually finished. Right? So when you got your, so here is at time t equal to 18 seconds, job 3 has gotten its 10 seconds of CPU time. Okay, at that point it will finish because it needs 10. So you see that 18 is the completion time. Okay, so there are two subs. So one is how much CPU time you have received. The other is what's the current time in the system. Okay, when your CPU time becomes equal to the job length, then you finish. And that becomes your completion time. Is that clear? Okay, any other questions here? So this should clarify exactly how IO bound jobs, how CPU bound jobs behave. Okay, so you probably have to understand this well enough to work through similar examples.
So it's pretty much like whatever the current time is of the job, it's the sequence of how they appear in the...
Yes. So this is exactly working out who's going to get executed at what time and how much CPU time you received, what queue you belong to at any given time. So that's what this is showing.
Should
okay.
You expect yes. To be able to work something out like that on the midterm?
Yeah.
Like that exact.
Homework probably first to get some warm up and then midterm. Yes. Okay. Wait time. So first remember what is the definition of wait time. Wait time is the time for which you are waiting in the ready queue. Okay. So typically wait time is, as I was mentioning last time, take the completion time and you take the difference between that and the job length. Okay? Then you do minus arrival time. And then, so that typically wait time. Okay? Wait time would also include IO because you are waiting there. Okay? It's the time which you are waiting to do IO or waiting in the ready queue. So they just basically just blindly do this. If all jobs arrive at time t equal to 0, then there is a difference between completion time and job length, which is essentially these two columns. And these two columns is this, this column and this column is that. Okay. So it's simply how much time are you waiting in the system. So you take the time you actually ran on the CPU, take the completion time, the difference between the two has to be the time you are waiting, because you are not running at that. Right. So that's what it means. Any other questions on this? Is this clear? Am I left you? So this is what, as I was mentioning, this is what Unix schedulers would do. Okay. They implement some variant of MLFQ. Okay, so if you take Linux or other schedulers, this is what you see in those systems. So then there is this other issue of how do you make this scheduler fair. Okay. So just as in shortest job first, okay, there was an unfairness problem. Okay, remember what was the unfairness problem there? Okay, because you are favoring the short jobs over long jobs. If there is a long job in the system, okay, that's waiting, and there is a arrival of continuous arrival of short jobs, this long job does not get to run. Okay, so the starvation, the unfairness problem was the starvation problem, where steady arrival of short jobs could starve out long jobs. They would have to wait forever, never get to run. Okay? So question is, can something like that happen here? So just MLFQ have a unfairness or a starvation problem? Right. This is a priority scheduler. Okay. It should be clear that in any priority scheduler, if you have a steady arrival of higher priority jobs, you can always starve out low priority jobs. Okay. So in this particular case, once the CPU bound jobs drop to Q2, if this queue never becomes empty, you will never go to this queue. Okay. So you could envision a scenario where there is always some IO bound job that has just become ready. Okay, so you always just schedule that, and then it goes back to doing IO, and just before it does that, another IO bound job becomes ready. So this queue never becomes empty. So these CPU bound jobs will never execute. So you dropped in priority, but unless this queue becomes empty, you will never go and execute anything here. Okay. So you will have an unfairness problem even in MLFQ. Okay. The assumption is IO bound jobs do not take long on the CPU. Okay, and they go back to doing IO, so you will not have a scenario where there is always some IO bound job ready to run. Okay? But if you have that scenario, you will starve out your CPU bound jobs. Okay, so now what do we do? How do we fix this problem? Okay. Yeah, so the only way to avoid starvation is to explicitly check for starvation and do something about it. Right? So if there are jobs waiting in lower priority queues that haven't run for a long time, let's say it was 5 minutes, I'm just picking a number, 5 minutes since this job ran last, there have been hundreds of jobs that have executed in the higher priority queue, then you say, okay, this job is starving, we need to give it some CPU time. Okay? How do we do that? We can either bump that job up, saying let's move it higher. So if a job hasn't run, it keeps rising until it actually gets a turn to run, then it drops again. Okay, so you can, this is called dynamic priorities. Okay? So to prevent starvation, if there are jobs that are not getting CPU time for a long period of time, you keep increasing its priority, so it keeps rising until it actually runs for some time. So that's one way to do it. The other way to do this is not have a strict priority between these two queues. You can spend some time, this is still higher priority, you can spend some time here, and then if you haven't executed any of the lower priority jobs, you explicitly ignore the highest priority queue and go down and execute something else. Okay. So these are the two solutions here, which says that there may be starvation. So it says give each queue a fraction of the CPU time. So don't do strict priority. Strict priority always says go to the highest priority queue and just run a job from there. That is non-empty. And then run a job from there. If you do that, then there may be jobs in the lower priority queue that may never execute. So the solution is, even though there may be higher priority job, don't do strict priority scheduling. Go and give some small fraction of CPU time to lower priority queues to prevent starvation. Okay? That's one. The other solution is what was just mentioned here, adjust the priority of the jobs. Okay, so if there are jobs that are sitting in the lower priority queue for long periods of time, are beginning to starve, increase their priority. Okay, this is what actually Unix did to address the starvation problem. As was mentioned here, the issue here is when there is high load, all jobs will rise in priority. So essentially, your multi-level feedback queue will degenerate to round-robin scheduling because every job will rise and you will just be doing round-robin here. Okay, so that's the problem with the approach, but that's at least prevents starvation. Any other questions on this? Okay, so these are practical concerns. Okay, that's the ML. That's why I said there are variants of MLFQ that are actually implemented. Because when you implement something in your operating system, you don't want these problems. Okay, you don't want your browser to become CPU bound and it doesn't run and your things hang and you don't like that. Okay, so you want every job that is there in your system to get some CPU time. So you have to get rid of problems like starvation and unfairness. Okay, so you have to make these tweaks to these schedulers. Okay. So next, or the last scheduling algorithm is called lottery scheduling. Okay. So this is the only scheduler that is randomized. Okay. All other schedulers are deterministic. Okay. So this one is going to use probabilities to decide which job to run. Okay. So the idea is very simple. Every job gets some number of lottery tickets. So all the jobs in the ready queue, okay, when it's time for the scheduler to pick a job, all the jobs in the ready queue put their lottery tickets in a hat, okay, and the scheduler runs a lottery, okay, and it picks one lottery ticket, and the job that owns that lottery ticket gets to run next. Okay, so it's randomized. So you basically, it's like saying I toss a coin, okay, and depending on who wins, that job gets to run next. Is the basic scheduler clear? I mean, it's a very simple algorithm. Okay, every job is assigned some number of lottery tickets. Okay, if you are in the ready queue and it's time for the scheduler to pick a job, okay, all jobs will pool their lottery tickets. You will run a lottery. You will pick one ticket to win. Okay, so you just randomly pick a ticket. Okay, and the job that holds the winning ticket gets to go next. Okay, very simple algorithm. So now what does this do? Okay, or why do we want to make the scheduling algorithm randomized? Okay, it's no longer deterministic. You can never guarantee that some job is going to run next. You have to basically see which one wins the lottery. Okay, and that job is going to go. So now, how does this work? Right? So basically, why even design a scheduler like this? So what the scheduling algorithm does is it allows you to control what fraction of CPU time each job is going to get. You can control this by assigning an appropriate number of lottery tickets. Okay, so very simple example is this. Okay, let's say two jobs, A and B. Okay, let's say both are CPU bound. There's no I/O. Sorry. Okay, so let's assume you give one lottery ticket to job A and two lottery tickets to job B. Okay, so then you could ask the question, on average, what fraction of CPU time does job A get and what fraction of CPU time does job B get? How will you decide or how will you compute the fraction of CPU time a job gets? Okay, so there's this proposal. This gets 33, this gets 66%. Okay, that's correct, but let's try to work out how we got there. Okay, so how do you decide what fraction of time job A is going to get? It depends on how many times it wins the lottery. Yeah, you will get as CPU time proportional to the number of times you win the lottery. Okay? If this is a random draw, okay, uniform random draw, how many times is job A going to win the lottery? Going to be half as many as B. Okay, so there are how many tickets do we have in the system? Three, right? So if you have three tickets, what's the probability of A winning the lottery? It's a third. It has one out of the three tickets. If you draw it at random, out of every three lotteries, it is going to win one on an average. Yeah, that's basically how distributions work. This wins the lottery 2/3 of the time. Okay. And the amount of CPU time is directly proportional to the number of times you win the lottery. So if you win the lottery a third of the time, you get a third of the CPU. Because a third of the time slices get assigned to you. If this one wins the lottery 2/3 of the time, then 2/3 of the time slices get assigned to job B. Okay. So if you control or you vary the number of lottery tickets here, you can vary the fraction of CPU time that these jobs get. Okay. And there are many systems where you want to carefully control how much CPU time these jobs get in the system. Particularly, so if you did 1:1 here, yes, and they would get equal CPU time. Okay, if you had a job C that also has one lottery ticket, they will all get equal CPU time. Okay, that should be clear. The amount of CPU time is proportional to the number of tickets you have. Each has one ticket, so each one gets a third of the CPU. Okay, but that's all, that's equal. Okay, because each one is going to win one out of three lotteries. Okay, so each gets a third, 33% of the CPU, which is equal.
So first you randomize the number of tickets they get, and then you try to sort the scheduling.
Yeah. So basically, as I was saying, what happens? So let's assume that you are given some number of lottery tickets. Let's assume they are numbered, right? So let's just say lottery ticket number 1, this is number 2, number
3. The number of jobs you have.
The number of lottery tickets is not the number of jobs you have. The number of lottery tickets, each job can be assigned any number of lottery tickets. It's like you go and you buy lottery tickets. Okay? The probability of you winning depends on the number of tickets you bought and the total number of tickets that have gotten sold. That's how lotteries work. Right? Same thing is true here. Right? So the probability of job B winning depends on how many tickets you have assigned. It could be any arbitrary number N. And the total number of tickets in the system. Okay? So basically what you will do. Okay, so this is in the abstract way. So if you assign N1, N2 and N3 lottery tickets here, the probability of any job winning a lottery ticket is NI, which is the number of tickets you gave it, and the total number of lottery tickets in the system, okay, which is summation of all of these quantities. Okay, so the number of lottery tickets is not equal to the number of jobs. It is typically going to be much greater than the number of jobs, because each job has more than one ticket, or could be given more than a ticket. Is this clear? Yes, there's a question there.
Doesn't this cause problems when more jobs are created?
Okay, so does this cause problems when more jobs are created? So as you create more jobs, there are more tickets in the system. Correct? Let's assume that simpler. For simplicity, we give each job only one ticket. You can analyze what happens. So let's assume there's only one job. Okay, there is only one ticket in the system. What happens if this is a CPU bound job? What's going to happen here? Okay, there is nothing. It's always going to win a lottery. It's only ticket. So it goes, it's 100% CPU. Okay. And that's the right thing to do. If there is only one job and it's CPU bound, it's going to run all the time. There is nothing else to schedule. Okay. So now we'll say there are two jobs. Each is given one ticket. Okay, what fraction of the CPU do you get? 50%. Okay, and that's again the right thing to do. There are two jobs, they have equal number of lottery tickets, both are CPU bound, each gets its fair share of the CPU, which is half. We share the CPU equally. Okay? And so you can do this for as many jobs as you want. So if each of them has one lottery ticket, they'll get one nth of the CPU, and n is the number of jobs. So as you increase the number of jobs, the CPU time you get reduces, but it's still fair. If there are n jobs sharing the CPU, each gets one nth of the CPU. Okay, so in that sense, it is fair. But that's exactly what will happen in any other system. As you have more load and you have more jobs, each will get less time. Okay, there are two questions. Yes. Don't you get nasty overheads from the randomizer? Here the CPU scheduler has to run a lottery. Okay, that is overhead. The more efficiently you can do this, the smaller will be your context switch overhead. Okay. So you are indeed correct in that the overhead of lottery scheduling will be higher than some other scheduler, deterministic scheduler. Okay. But that said, it's a fair scheduler. Okay, you can control the amount of CPU time you can receive. There's questions somewhere here and there. But yeah, yes, you are.
So like, introducing like longer running jobs and like shorter running jobs, is like distribution of tickets change?
Okay, so we'll come back to, just hold off on that. I have examples on the next slide which show you what will happen if you have long jobs and short jobs and whatnot. Okay, so you have a question.
Yeah.
What happens if you get additional jobs? Yeah, so what you do is every time you have a ready queue, you take all the jobs that are in the ready queue, run a lottery. Okay? Next time you schedule again, some more jobs may have arrived. Okay, so the number of tickets has changed. Okay, so that's essentially what is going to happen. So you still run the lottery every time, just the jobs that participate in the lottery will keep changing. Okay, so now we'll come back to all these questions that were asked about long jobs and short jobs. Okay, so here we have, what do we have? Okay, so here is an example. Okay, so it's there are two types of jobs in the system, long jobs and short jobs. Okay, say that short jobs get 10 tickets and long jobs get 1 ticket. Okay, this is trying to approximate, as you can see, it is trying to approximate shortest job first because you are giving more tickets to short jobs, okay, thereby favoring short jobs. More tickets you have, the greater are the chances of you winning the lottery. Okay, so if you want to favor short jobs, you give short jobs more tickets. If you want to favor long jobs, for whatever reason, you can give long jobs more tickets. Okay? So this is giving 10 tickets to short jobs, get long jobs get 1 ticket. The first example here, the first row here says there's one short job and one long job. Okay? And then what happens as a result of that? Okay, what fraction of CPU time is your short job going to get? What fraction of CPU time does your long job get? Yes. Yeah, so this is your formula, right? Any time I ask you what fraction of the CPU time you get, you take the number of tickets you are given, take the total number of tickets, that fraction is the fraction of CPU time you are going to get. It's also the probability of you winning the lottery. Okay, so if you have a short job that has 10 tickets and a long job that has 1 ticket and there are only these two jobs in the system, there are 11 lottery tickets. So the probability that the short job gets chosen or wins the lottery is 10 over 11. The probability that the long job gets chosen is 1 over 11. Okay? And this is approximately 91%. That's approximately 9%. Okay? So short jobs gets 91% of the CPU as a result of this lottery assignment. Okay? You could change the assignment any way you want. Okay, and that will change the fraction of the CPU time. You as in the user can change the lottery tickets assigned to a job. Okay? So that's one and one. So here is another example. Zero short jobs, two long jobs. Okay, so what fraction of the CPU does each long job get? Equal. Right? So basically two long jobs, each has one ticket. Okay, so each gets 50% of the CPU. Yes, there are no long short jobs, so there is nothing here. Okay, this gets 50% each. Okay, swapped here. Okay, two short jobs, zero long jobs. Same thing. Okay, each has 10. Total number of tickets is 20. So probability of winning the lottery is 10 over 20, which is same, half. Okay, each has half the lottery ticket, so this is 50%. Okay, there are no long jobs. Okay, here you have 10 short jobs, one long job. What's the fraction of CPU time each short job gets? Okay. So just go back to this. Okay, what's the number of tickets a short job has? 10. Well, that's what you give. Each short job got 10 tickets. That's what is specified here. Okay. How many tickets do you have in the system? Okay. There are 10 short jobs. Each has 10 tickets. So it's 100 short tickets for all the short jobs. It's one long job that has one ticket. Okay. So 101 tickets in all. Okay, so the fraction of the CPU time each short job gets is 10 over 101. Okay, fraction of CPU time each long job gets 1 over 101. So the long jobs here is going, the long job there is going to get approximately 1% of the CPU. Okay, each short job gets approximately 10% of the CPU. Okay, so now you can flip this. Okay, there's only one short job, there are 10 long jobs. So you basically do the same thing. So for short jobs, there's only one of them, and they have 10 tickets. Total number of CPU tickets is what? Okay, so 50% of the time is given to that one short job. Okay, the remaining 50% gets equally divided among these 10 jobs, long jobs. Okay, that's basically, so each long job has one. So that's basically 5%. So that remaining 50% gets split across those long jobs. So each gets 5%, and this gets 50%. Okay, so that's what you will see here. So this is 50% is 50. Here you have 10 in one. So this short job gets 50%. Long jobs each get 5%. So what this is saying is you can decide how much lottery tickets to give to a job. And it will get CPU time in proportional to the tickets it holds. And you can vary that if you feel that the job isn't getting enough CPU time or is getting too much. And the scheduler is just doing a randomized draw and running these jobs.
So it has nothing to do with priority or anything?
There's no priority. So you can emulate priority by giving a job more and more tickets. Okay, so more and more tickets basically means the probability of winning the lottery keeps going up, so it gets favored over other jobs. Okay, that's equivalent to priority. Okay, so you can control the CPU time. It's not real priority. It's just emulating what priority scheduler would do by favoring some jobs over others. Okay, that you can do that by increasing the number of tickets you're given. Okay, so it is a randomized scheduler. There's no priority here. Yes, question.
So say you have a job that's doing a lot of
Okay, that's a good question. So if you wanted to use lottery scheduling to emulate MLFQ, okay, what you should do in that case is you have to figure out which jobs are going to do IO, okay, and then give it more tickets. Okay, so when that job becomes ready to run, it gets the probability of it winning the lottery are high, so it gets to run quickly and go back to doing IO. Okay, the only difference between MLFQ and lottery scheduling is here the burden is on the user to figure out which job is IO bound and assign appropriate number of tickets. Okay? In MLFQ, the scheduler decides this based on the actual behavior of the job. Okay? But that is exactly what you would do to favor IO bound jobs. You would probably give them more tickets and fewer to CPU bound jobs. Okay? Any other questions here? Okay, so that's all we have to say about scheduling. So we are going to move on to the next topic here, which is going to be synchronization. Okay, so this is going to be a key topic because your next real programming assignment that's coming up will involve threads and synchronization. Okay, so we already looked at threads, I think two or three classes ago, and today we will start looking at synchronization. Okay, so to explain this notion of synchronization, that we'll use a real world example, okay, and then we'll try to address this example, try to figure out how can you do synchronization. Okay, so the example is as follows. Okay, so let's assume that you and your roommate are trying to coordinate, okay, some task. Okay, here the task is to ensure that if you run out of milk, okay, you go buy milk. Okay, very simple task. Okay, so this is basically a timeline. Okay, so it says you arrive home, you look in the fridge, there is no milk, you go to the grocery store. Okay. Time 3:10, 3:15, your roommate arrives, okay, looks in the fridge, still no milk, you haven't come back, okay, goes to the grocery store, and while your roommate is going to the grocery store, you have come back, you put milk in the fridge, okay, your roommate goes, buys milk, comes back, and puts milk in the fridge, and now you have too much milk, okay. So the reason you have too much milk is there's no coordination here. Yeah, so you and your roommate didn't really coordinate. You made unilateral decision saying there isn't milk, I need to go buy milk. Okay. Then the question is, how do you coordinate, okay, this very simple task of buying milk so that you get the right properties? And the right properties are, you should neither have too much milk nor should you have too little milk. Okay. So the opposite version of this problem would be, you come home, you look in the fridge, you say no milk, say my roommate is going to buy milk, and you go do something else. Your roommate does the same thing, okay, and then you come back home and there is no milk. Okay, you don't want that property either. Okay. Okay. So we'll try to understand how to do synchronization using this example. Okay. So there are two or three terms I will introduce here, and we'll come back to this as we go along. Okay. So first one is, what is synchronization? So this is basically the use of atomic operation to ensure some cooperation. Typically, it's cooperation between threads. It could also be cooperation between processes. Okay? So you want to have some operations that allow this coordination or cooperation. Okay? And the way you do this, the way you do synchronization is using the next three terms. Okay? The first one is called mutual exclusion. So mutual exclusion basically says that only one thread does a particular thing and it excludes other threads from doing that activity. Okay, so it's basically some activity that you do, and by doing that activity you are actually preventing some other threads from doing that activity. That's called mutual exclusion. Okay? Mutual exclusion is implemented using the notion of critical section and locks. Okay? Critical section is a piece of code that only one thread can execute. Okay? And if that thread is executing that piece of code, all other threads are prevented from executing that piece of code. Okay? In the previous example, that piece of code could be the task of you going and buying milk. So if somehow you could, if you are doing this, you could prevent your roommate from doing that, then you have mutual exclusion and critical sections. Okay? And lock is a mechanism that you use to implement critical section, and it basically prevents other processes from doing this. Okay? The way you do this is, before you enter critical section, which is a piece of code, you try to acquire a lock, okay? And as you exit the critical section, you will release the lock. We'll come back to the notion of a lock after we do a few more too much milk examples. Okay? So the basic point is, all synchronization is going to involve waiting. If you are going to coordinate, okay, this means that somebody has to wait to figure out what some other person did or what some other thread did to ensure correctness. Okay? Because if you again unilaterally go and do something without waiting or without checking what somebody else is doing, then you will get bad properties like what we saw. Okay, so synchronization is going to involve waiting and blocking of some sort, as we will see. So here is a solution. Okay, there is a piece of code that you will execute. Okay, you have two correctness properties that you want. Okay, one is that only one person should buy milk. Okay, and the other one is called, other one says somebody should buy milk, which means you don't want a case where nobody gets milk. Okay, the first one in distributed systems terminology is called a safety property. Again, the second one is called liveness property. Safety property says nothing bad happens. Okay? If you have too much milk, that's bad. Okay? Liveness property says that something good happens. Okay? If you have no milk, then nothing good has happened. Okay? So that's just a comment. But these are the two properties. One is actually called a safety property, which you don't need to know what safety and liveness is, but that's essentially what they are. Okay? So now we will assume, okay, for the purpose of this solution, first solution, that loads and stores, the operations on a machine, are atomic. Okay, atomic says that the whole operation can actually happen without it getting interrupted. Okay, so the whole operation happens or nothing happens. That's what atomicity means. Okay, it's all or nothing. That's what it means. Okay, so what does that mean? It says leaving a note is an atomic operation. Okay, which means that you can leave a note and you will not get interrupted while you're doing that. Removing a note, okay, atomic operation, okay, not going to buy milk if there's a note which is a weight is also an atomic operation. Okay. So basic point is, now you are trying to coordinate. Okay, so what you are going to do is, if you find that the refrigerator is empty and you go to buy milk, you will leave a note. You say, I have gone to get milk. So the assumption is when your roommate comes, he will first check the note. Okay, and then say, okay, I don't need to do it because my roommate has gone to do it. Okay. So here is your simple solution. Okay. It says if there is no milk and then there is no note on the fridge, then you leave a note, you go buy milk, and then you come back and remove a note. Okay. Your roommate also does the same thing. Okay. If there is no milk and then there is no note, you leave a note, okay, you go buy milk and you remove a note. Okay. This is your protocol. Okay. So now what happens? Does this work? Yeah, it doesn't work. Why does it not work? Sorry?
We already know from last semester.
You already know from last semester. So we will ignore the extra knowledge you gained. We'll try to come back and say, okay, why would this not work? In your real world scenario, what could happen here? Okay, and then what happened?
Real life scenario doesn't really relate to the kind of simulation.
Like, you know, no, you can come up with scenarios. I'll tell you a scenario. So here is a scenario. Okay, so you come home. Okay, you basically check the fridge. There's no milk, okay, and then there's no note on the fridge. Okay, you say, okay, I need to go buy milk. Then you say, okay, let me go and keep my laptop in my room or something like this. Okay? You haven't, and after you come back, you're going to actually leave a note and leave the house. But you haven't done that yet. You just came and checked this and you went off to do something else. Okay? Your roommate came home and they checked that there is no milk. They checked that there is no note and they actually said, I need to get milk, but let me go do something and then do it. Okay? So then after your roommate has checked, you come back to the fridge and you leave a note. Okay? And then you go get milk, and then you come back home and you remove the note. The same thing happens to your roommate that after, because once you already checked, you assume that you will not check. So you come back and you will leave a note, you will go buy milk and you will remove the note, and you have too much milk. Okay. So in the context of threads, the way this works is as follows. So you will execute this instruction. Okay. You will say, okay, there is no milk and there is no note. Okay. So clearly now you are going to go into this if part and you will execute this code. Okay. But as soon as you do this, let's say your time slice expires. Because we just did CPU scheduling. So your time slice is expired, you go back to the end of the ready queue. Okay. This thread will run next. Okay. So it will execute this instruction. There is still no milk. Okay. There is still no note. Okay. So as soon as you execute this instruction, let's say the time slice for this thread expires. So it goes back to the end of the ready queue. And then thread A starts running again. Okay. Thread A then enters the if. Okay. You leave a note, you buy milk, you remove the note. Okay. And then thread B runs next, it enters the if. You leave a note, you buy milk, and you remove a note. Okay. So now you have too much milk. Okay. Is that clear what happens in the case of threads? Because of context switching and scheduling, you can each execute just this instruction and context switch and cause both of these threads to enter the if. And then as a result, you will have too much milk. It will not happen all the time. Okay? Because it could be the case that you actually execute this instruction, you go into the if and you execute that instruction, you leave a note. At that point, if thread B runs, then it is not going to enter the if. Okay? This is called a race condition. There are certain execution sequences in which you get incorrect execution. Okay? And in certain cases, you will get proper execution. Yeah, but that still means this code doesn't work, yeah, because you want to have it right all the time, not right some of the time. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so here is solution 2. Okay, so now what we have done is we have moved the leave note outside. So here thread goes, leaves a note, okay, and then checks, is there a note from B? Okay, if there is no note from B, you get check if there is no milk. If there is no milk, you buy milk and then you remove a note. Okay. So thread B does the same thing. It leaves a note. First it leaves a note and then it checks, did A also leave a note? If so, there's nothing for you to do. You come back and remove the node. But if not, then you go. Say, I left a node. A has not left a node. So then you go and check whether there is milk. If there is no milk, then it's your turn to go buy milk. And then you come out and leave a node, remove the node. Is that code clear, what it's doing? You leave a note and you check, did your roommate leave a note? No. Is there milk? No. You go buy milk, come put the milk and you remove your note. Okay, that's simple algorithm. Question is this going to work? Can you construct a scenario where both threads will go buy milk? Yes.
They both leave the note at the same time.
Okay, they both leave a note at the same time, then what happens?
Then when you do the checkup, if no note, then it'll go back to the beginning.
Okay. Yeah. So this, so here is the execution sequence, right? So thread A runs. Okay, you leave a note. Okay. Time slice expires. Thread A stops running, goes back to the end of the ready queue. Okay, so it is basically just left a note, that's all it has done. Thread B runs. It also leaves, the first instruction leaves a note, left a note. Okay, then the time slice expires again. Okay, goes back to the end of the ready queue. A starts running. Okay, then it executes the next instruction. It says, is there a node from B? Is there a node from B? Okay, there is a node, B left a node. They say, there is nothing for me to do. Okay, so it basically executes the if, removes the node. Okay, and then thread B runs. Yeah, it goes to the next instruction, it says, is there a node from A? But we'll assume that before it removes a node, let's say the time slice expires here. It just checks this if condition, is time slice expire. Okay, and then B runs. Yes, there's still a node from A, it hasn't removed, it hasn't executed that instruction. It says, is there a node? Yes. Okay, so it exits the if loop. Okay, and then both of them remove their node. Okay, so you have a condition where there is no milk, but neither of them bought milk. Because each of them assumed that the other one was going to do it. Okay, and then they didn't do anything. Okay, so you violated your liveness property, which is these threads could keep executing in a while loop. Each one checks, there's a note from someone else, they don't do anything. Okay, and then the other one assumes that this thread is going to do something, this thread assumes the other one. Okay, so this context switches and interleaving of threads using this context switches causes neither of these threads to do the task you want them to do. Okay, so you again violated your property, which is somebody should buy milk. Okay. This one basically violated the first property, only one person should buy milk. So you have too much milk here. Okay, the next solution, there isn't any milk. Okay, so this doesn't work. Okay. Any questions on this? Is it clear what I said? Why you will not get any milk in this case? Okay. Here's a fancy solution. So here what we do, thread A is going to leave a note. Okay. And then it goes into while loop. Say if there is a note from B, just sit there. Okay, just keep looping. Do nothing, meaning it just keeps looping here, waits for the note from B to go away. If there is no note, of course this you will basically just come out here, you check that there is no milk, you will go buy milk and you'll remove note A. Okay. And this one, this code is unchanged from the last solution. Okay, basically, you just leave a note. There is no note you, and no milk, you go buy milk. Okay, so this is what this is doing is equivalent of you coming and you leaving a note and you see checking the refrigerator saying, is there a note? Okay, if there is a note, you just stand there. Okay, you wait for your roommate to either come back with milk or take the note off, and then you go and check. Okay, this is basically this thread not trusting that thread, saying, I'm going to wait. You left a note, but you may not buy milk in the end, so I will still wait for you to take your note off, and then I will check. Did you actually buy milk, or is there still no milk? If there's no milk, I go buy milk. Okay, so that's basically what this does. Does it work? It works. Because if you don't trust and you keep checking, and then eventually you will buy milk or your roommate will end up buying milk. Okay. Now, there is a formal way to argue for the correctness of this code. Okay, so you basically say what happens at either this point or this point. Okay, this is called X. These are 2 points. You can reason. Okay, so at point Y, which is here, okay, thread B, you say if there is no note, then it's safe for the thread to check and buy milk if needed, because thread A hasn't even started. It hasn't left a note. So it's fine for you to go ahead and do that. Okay, but if there is a note from A, then you basically don't worry about it. Okay, because A is already going to keep checking here. Okay, so if there's already a note, then you are going to just remove your note. Okay, and then thread A is going to keep waiting, and you have just removed the note without buying milk, so it will go in here, buy milk. Okay, and then you reason about what A does. So you check at point X either there is a note from B or not. If there is no note from B, it's fine for you to go ahead and buy milk, because B hasn't started, or B has already removed, started and finished. Okay, it actually started and it removed the note, which is why there was no note. Okay. But if there is a note from B, then you just sit in a loop saying, let me see what B does. Left a note, is he really going to buy milk or not? Okay. Then if you find that you don't buy milk, you go buy milk. Okay. So it's a complicated process to reason that this works. Okay. But there are problems with this approach. Okay. It's a complicated approach. It's hard to convince yourself that this is correct. You have to reason about all these possibilities and then say, okay, I looked at every possibility and it looks like no matter what happens, somebody is going to buy milk, nobody is going to buy extra milk, so this code is going to work. Okay? It is asymmetric. Okay? The code for thread A and code for thread B are different. Okay? So you basically, in all previous solutions, both threads actually had the same code. Okay? They were doing exactly the same thing. Here, one thread does something different. Okay? So we don't deal with threads dying, crashing. These doesn't deal with crashes. Assume that threads are running. If processes crash, you need extra code to detect that and do something. Okay, so crashes are not accounted for. Okay, so we'll not assume that your roommate went to get milk, got hit by a car or something like that. So that thread is not considered here. Okay, so it's asymmetric. Okay, so thread A and B do something different. More problematic is if you wanted to generalize this to n threads, each thread would have to have a slightly different code for it to all work. Okay, it gets messy very quickly. Okay, and the last problem is thread A is doing busy wait. The busy wait is it's just sitting in a loop, checking and doing nothing. Okay, this is wasted cycles because it doesn't do anything. It just says I just keep doing a useless loop, is waiting for that node to go away. Okay, this is referred to as a busy wait, where you are busy waiting. Okay, you are actually running in a loop waiting. It consumes CPU resources despite the fact that it doesn't do any useful work. Okay, so busy wait typically are something to avoid, okay, because you just sit in a loop doing useless work. Okay, so you don't want that. Okay, so you want to get rid of all of these issues. Okay, the code works. Okay, but A, it's messy, it doesn't generalize, it involves busy waiting. So it has three problems that we want to get rid of. Okay, now keep in mind that it still relies on loads and stores being atomic. Okay, some of these operations of leaving node are atomic. You can't get interrupted on a time slice while you are in the midst of leaving node. That would cause additional problems. Okay, so what you want are primitives or some methods that simplify the solution to this problem. You don't want to have all of this ugliness. You want some simple code that you can that gives you some assurance that it will work. Okay? So this is what synchronization primitives will give you. Okay? So there are some languages that support synchronization. Others do it using libraries. In case of Java, you find that language level support. In case of C and C++, you have to actually use a library. But whatever it is, the primitives that you get at the end of the day are very similar. Okay, there are three synchronization primitives that we'll study. The first one that we'll look at today is called a lock. Okay, so this ensures that this property says only one process or only one thread can hold a lock at any time. Okay, and it enters its critical section. If it holds a lock, it blocks everyone else. Okay, we'll see how to do that as soon as we go to the next few slides. Okay, the then there's notion of semaphores. Semaphores are more generalized versions of locks. Okay, these are this generalizes notion. They can do some more things that locks would require additional code to do. Okay, and then the last concept is that of monitors. Okay, monitors typically allow you to take shared data. Okay, and use synchronization on access of shared data. Okay, as we will see next time, not today, we will see that there require you need hardware level support to implement all of these things. Today we'll just look at locks and look at the abstraction of locks. Next time we'll study what hardware level support do you actually need to implement locks. Okay, so today is just what are locks, and next time we'll look at how do you implement lock. Okay, so here is what locks does. Okay, it's a way to implement mutual exclusion, and it has two routines or two methods. So there's an acquire method and there's a release method. Okay, so acquire method basically says that wait until the lock is free and then grab the lock. Okay, so if you do lock dot acquire, okay, then this method checks is the lock either available or is it free. If nobody holds the lock at this point in time, then it's said to be available. Okay, if some other thread has already grabbed the lock, then it is not available. Okay, so what acquire method will do is if the lock is not free, it will block. It will just wait, do nothing. Okay, and then when the lock becomes free, it grabs it. And if the lock is already available, then it can grab it right away.
Is this a Java API?
This is not Java API, this is pseudocode. Okay, but there are lock implementations that you will see. Okay, so this will map on to different things in Java, C, C++, etc. Okay, in C, C++, you will use pthreads to implement locks. Yes.
I was just saying, for C, you have to put the waiting on there to
yes.
check again. In Java, do you still have to do the same thing?
Depends on which lock implementation. Java supports monitors out of the box, but locks are not supported out of the box. Locks are actually implemented on top as higher level primitives. Okay, so it doesn't have language level support. So it depends on which implementation. Okay, so that's lock.acquire. So lock.release, okay, basically says that if you are done, you have grabbed the lock, you did something, and if you are done, then you go ahead and release the lock. Okay, so what this will do is if there is nobody waiting for the lock, it will mark the lock as free. If there is some process that did lock.acquire and is now waiting because you held the lock, then it will give the lock to that process. Okay, and that process will acquire the lock. Okay, and how do you use it? These are the rules. This is how you write code. Always acquire a lock before accessing shared data or entering a critical section. Always release the lock after you are done. Okay, and initially the lock state is free, okay, meaning that the lock is available. Okay, now here is our too much milk solution using locks. Okay, very simple code. Okay, you just have a lock. So thread A says lock.acquire. And then you go check if there is no milk, buy milk. Once you are done, you release the lock. Okay? Thread B does same thing. Doesn't acquire. Okay? And then it goes, and this is your critical section. Okay? This piece of code is called a critical section. It is protected by a lock. Okay? Before the critical section, you always do an acquire. At the end of the critical section, you always do a release. Okay? And just by the semantics of what we did before, this ensures that you will neither get too much or too little milk. So if you can take any execution sequence, so you can say I acquire a lock, initially thread A runs, let's say the lock is free, you execute acquire, it gets the lock, it grabs the lock and it enters here, okay, it immediately enters the critical section, and then it can execute this code. Okay, while it is executing the code, there could be a context switch, doesn't matter. Okay, let's say it's in the middle of the critical section, you have to give up the time slice, that's fine. Okay, thread B is going to run. It's going to do a lock.acquire, okay, and it will immediately block. It cannot proceed because the lock is in use. This thread has the lock. Okay, so there is nothing thread B can do if thread A has the lock and vice versa. Okay, so thread B is not even going to run. So it has to wait until thread A releases the lock. Okay, at this point, it has already checked if there isn't any milk, and if so, it has gone and bought milk, and then it releases. And then thread B will eventually get the lock. It will enter here. It's already milk, there's nothing to do. Release the lock. Okay? Simple, clean, symmetric code. Okay? And the semantics of lock is guaranteed to you that anything between an acquire and release only one thread can execute at a time. This is guaranteed. If somebody is executing this part of code, it's guaranteed that any other thread, okay, will be blocked from executing the same code. Okay, so only one person can do this at a time. This is like saying, if I'm going to buy milk, I'm guaranteed that my roommate is blocked from doing anything. Or vice versa. So you have to wait until the whole process of checking whether there is milk, going, buying milk and putting it back in the fridge is like one operation, and your roommate has to wait until the whole process is even finished before it can even check whether there is milk in the fridge. Okay, that's essentially what locks have done for you. Okay, is that clear? Any questions on this? Okay, so next time we will actually check. So I only showed you how locks are used in application code. We didn't actually see what is the magic that the acquire and release has to do internally to make this atomic. What is it that causes your lock.acquire to block if thread A holds the lock and whatnot? So that we will check next time. Okay, so let's stop here.